This is Functional Medicine Update for February 1999, Volume 18, Number 2. In this edition, our theme will be functional neurology and brain behavior. We will examine studies on genetics, biochemistry, and the molecular basis of variant human phenotypes, cognitive dysfunction in children, a case study of corrected gene factors, new research on amino acid dysfunction, and the effect of environment enrichment on the physiology of the brain. Our clinician interview on side two is with Dr. Michael R. Lyon, discussing his research on attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD. We will conclude this month's issue with three reports related to pharmaceuticals: a new look at battling quackery, self-scripting among resident physicians, and the need for drug monitoring. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the February 1999 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
This month, we're going to be speaking extensively about the brain, and specifically focusing on functional neurology from a pediatric perspective. We are confronted, as you know, with ever-increasing numbers of diagnoses of aberrant brain function and behavior that are encoded with names such as attention disorder, hyperactivity dysfunction, ADHD, or autism, as we discussed in the January issue of 1999 Functional Medicine Update. And yet we might ask, is there a common theme that weaves these together, something that clinicians can actually get their hands around and assist parents and their children to achieve higher levels of function and not suffer through years of less than optimal self-esteem and problems in school and dysfunctions in the home, an adulthood that might be somewhat cast in a negative perspective given the collection of bad experiences that occurred throughout the childhood, that pattern the individual into feeling that they're a loser, that they're incapable of being successful in the world, that they have lost their locus of control, that their self-esteem and self-value has been so compromised as to then translate itself into not just only behavior disorder, but also to physiological problems, as we described in previous issues of Functional Medicine Update. It's interesting to note because this theme will be further amplified and discussed at the 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine being held this May 24th through 26th in Tucson, Arizona. The title of that has to do with intracellular messengers and functional medicine intervention and problems related to dysfunctional communication among organs, tissues, cells, and individuals. We might subtitle this 6th International Symposium, Functional Medicine Interface with Body-Mind Medicine. As you know, we've got some fairly exciting speakers that will be presenting from this perspective in May. Dr. Candice Burt, Dr. Michael Ruff, talking about their extraordinary discoveries of the neurotransmitter receptor sites on white blood cells and how our whole body is intercommunicating messages of external observation into immunological and neurological function. Looking at the relationship of melatonin as a cell signaling molecule that has polyorgan effects with Dr. David Blask, an MD, PhD, who's specially is in the area of neuroendocrine signal regulating effects. And then moving on from there into some very exciting discussions of cancer gene intracellular communication and modification of expression with Vincent Castronovo from the previous National Cancer Institute and now doing the work as the head of the chemical carcinogenesis and oncogenesis laboratory at the University of Liège Medical School in Belgium. Dr. Joanna Lampe talking about soy isoflavones and Dr. George Sabrecki about zinc finger modulation and oncogene expression. And then moving on into the last day, a discussion by Robert Sapolsky, Stanford University neurophysiologist at the medical school, talking about stress-modulated mediators and messengers and how that interrelates to sex steroid hormones and his wonderful new book on testosterone and other essays related to modulation of behavior by small molecules. Very fascinating work coming out of his previous book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And then Dr. Robert Learman from the Boston University Medical School, talking about fatty acids, eicosanoids, and heart disease as cell signaling interrelationships. and Kilmer McCulley to come back and visit with us as to what's happened in the homocysteine area over the course of this last year. So it's going to be a most interesting discussion of the functional medicine interface with body-mind medicine, and some very nice workshops in the afternoon that will be delving into these topics from a clinical applied perspective. So again, I urge you, if you have not already made your plans to be with us at the 6th International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Tucson, Arizona, May 24th through 26th, that you please give it strong consideration. I think you'll find the program to be quite extraordinary. And I owe a deep debt of thanks to one of our long-standing functional medicine supporters, a clinician that I have great respect for, Dr. Scott Anderson, a physician in Fairfax, California, who has taken the time out of his busy schedule and world to drop me a very insightful letter saying that he feels that I would be well served to cover some of the materials that are described in the 7th edition of the Metabolic and Molecular Basis of Inherited Disease, which is considered the text of record that helps us to understand inherited disease. Because he says the 7th edition contains materials that are codified as fact that so resemble what functional medicine is built upon and the molecular medicine concept of Dr. Linus Pauling that it seems extraordinarily important to let the other listeners of functional medicine know that we have gone from a period of speculation and conjecture to a period of acceptance and understanding. In fact, he goes on to say in his nice letter to me, I feel that this must be read, the new 7th edition of the Metabolic and Molecular Basis of Inherited Disease. Although you have been stressing the nutritional modification as one of the main strategies to have the ability to modify gene expression, the authors of this 7th edition of Metabolic and Molecular Basis of Inherited Disease go one step further to suggest that genetics is rapidly becoming the very basis of medicine. Thus, the ideas that you have been teaching us from the margin have become certified grade A mainstream. Furthermore, Child in his A Logic of Disease chapter gives a most elegant presentation of how clinical practice can be built on these ideas. I've spoken to Childs about making this chapter into a book. He thinks that this may be a way of teaching doctors as to what the revolution is at the interface as it pertains to the underpinning of medicine in the future. So the 7th edition of the Metabolic and Molecular Basis of Inherited Disease, what does it say to us? Well, in the preface, I think it says something that's very prescient and timely. We take, I guess you would say, some great credit in functional medicine to feel that we are on target. It appears as if we are traveling in the mainstream of where medical thinking is taking us. It says that the reviewer of the 6th edition reminded us that the book was to provide and present pertinent clinical, biochemical, and genetic information concerning metabolic anomalies grouped under what Dr. Archibald Gerard in 1902 had the engaging term inborn errors of metabolism. The term molecular was added belatedly as a consequence of the understanding more of what Dr. Linus Pauling had discussed in his landmark article in 1949 on sickle cell anemia, a molecular disease. The inborn errors of metabolism are simply our most obvious illustrations of the genetic variation that affects health and the molecular underpinning of the variation, he goes on to say in the preface to the book. A corresponding analysis of multifactorial diseases is the next obvious step in the understanding disease across the range of chronic degenerative disease. In the preface, they go on to say that there are a number of new topics that have been added to molecular disease and the inborn errors of metabolism, including pharmacogenetics, a topic that we've discussed extensively over the last several months in Functional Medicine Update, which is the study of the relationship of a genetic uniqueness in detoxification of various substances and the potential adverse effects to exposure to those substances based upon that uniqueness in detoxification. The pharmaceutical industries are all now worried about pharmacogenetics because of the ever-increasing recognition that certain genotypes of detoxification status are unable to metabolize certain families of drugs, increasing the risk to adverse drug reactions significantly as a consequence of those genetic imperfections or genetic mutations. Also, it says that their mapping of genes, the genomics field, has now become a major part of molecular disease and inherited diseases. with the increased awareness that mutant gene expression may involve more than conventional Mendelian inheritance. For example, we know about imprinting and mosaicism, which are indications that it's not simple a Mendelian transference factors that give rise to the pleiotropic and polymorphic expression of genes. And then lastly, how do cellular organelles, such as the mitochondrion, and protein targeting and post-translational modification like phosphorylation or glycation or glucuronidation, and the HLA complex affect expression of genetic disease? Because each of these may be influenced by environmental factors that then change the genotype in its expression to phenotype. The genotype itself is obviously not changed, but what has changed is the relative way that the genotype gets expressed into its phenotype as a consequence of these environmental exposures that alter both gene expression and the post-translational effect on genes that create then secondary effects in terms of health and disease. A very interesting start of this month's Functional Medicine Update, because it takes us into recognizing that genetics, biochemistry, and the molecular basis of variant human phenotypes is the emerging view of the explanation of much of our age-related chronic degenerative disease. And we're only now starting to develop the tools, the perspective, and the intervention applications to these understandings to prevent unnecessary disease based upon an individual who has been, quote, plunged into a harmful environment, end quote, based upon their gene uniqueness that creates then the risk to disease, a personalized medicine risk to disease. The inborn error of disease was first, as I mentioned, discovered and described by Dr. Archibald Gerard. And it wasn't until, however, Beadle and Tatum developed the one gene, one enzyme concept later in the 20th century that it started to catch on as a thought that had validity. People had seen these things like fetal cutinuria and alkaptonuria clinically, but unable to kind of wrap their logical understanding around these diseases as being tied somehow to genes and metabolism. Remember, the birthing of biochemistry was only at the start of the 20th century, was still a very infant science, and therefore it took a while for this concept to catch on as part of medicine and the etiology of disease. Beadle and Tatum, with their one gene, one enzyme concept, which helped connect together metabolic function to genetic inheritance factors, started to allow this concept to gain much more of a understanding. In 1949, as I mentioned, Pauling and his classic work on sickle cell anemia gave birth to the concept of molecular disease, and this was, I think, enhanced and amplified by many other investigators who moved into this field, and including, obviously, the landmark discovery of the structure of DNA and the birthing of molecular biology with the Watson and Crick double-stranded helical configuration for the DNA molecule. And then we went from there to the molecular basis of gene expression and the molecular flow of information along the gene, the structure of how DNA could code through the triplet code to specific characteristics which could get turned on and turned off by certain kinds of agents and influences that would either suppress or upregulate gene expression. And then to the understanding of the fact that at the genetic level there was a much more significant diversity from one individual to another in their biochemical genetics than we might have thought on the basis of looking at their number of toes or fingers or eyes or nose, that humans look pretty similar to one another even though we have differing hair color, eye color, skin color, and some anthropometric changes from one person to another. It still looks like we're fairly similar within a narrow range of function. Not so at the biochemical level, says this kind of research that gave rise to the recognition of chemical individuality, what is called by Dr. Roger William biochemical individuality. And that led into the genetotrophic disease concept of Dr. Williams, where certain diseases were as a result of the inappropriate level of specific nutrients that were supplied that were necessary for improved expression of genes, that in the absence of these nutrients being present at the right time at the right amount resulted in imperfect expression or the phenotype resulting in expression of disease. The genetic linkage then to disease started to become a more important part of medical research and even clinical thinking. It takes us beyond the frank genetic metabolism disease of infancy that we often have learned about, the Tay-Sachs-Gauchers, Wilson's disease, Fabry's disease, into recognizing that there are functional abnormalities that are less early in their penetration that produce an increasing risk to midlife disorders that have been disorders of complex etiology without single causes. Coronary heart disease, certain forms of cancer, autoimmune disease, certain types of digestive disorders, what we might call wear and tear conditions that arise in midlife as a consequence of the imperfect match between genotype and the environment. A very fascinating, well, nearly 100-year history now of evolution in medicine, in which this concept has now gone from a theoretic base into a base of esotericism with just a few cases per 100,000 births of the frank genetic metabolism disease of infancy, to now where it may actually help us understand, explain, and lead to new therapies for virtually all of the midlife chronic degenerative diseases. That leads to this Barton Childs chapter in the text, which is a classic. A logic disease, in which he goes on to point out that it might be claimed that what used to be spoken of as a diathesis is nothing else but chemical individuality. Our chemical individualities are due to our chemical merits as well as our chemical shortcomings, he goes on to say. And it is more nearly true to say that the factors which confer upon us our predispositions to and immunities from the various misshapes which are spoken of as diseases are inherent in our very chemical structure. And even in the molecular groupings which confer upon us our individualities and which went to the making of our chromosomes from which we sprang. It's an interesting quote, isn't it? You might wonder from whence that was originated, because it sure sounds prescient and has a lot of contemporary ring to it. You might be very surprised to learn that that quote actually was taken from Archibald Gerard's Inborn Errors of Metabolism, published in Oxford University Press, 1909. Yeah, isn't it interesting how we learn old things in new ways? As I said, it wasn't until Beadle and Tatum developed the one gene, one enzyme concept that the prescience of Archibald Gerard was in fact understood within medicine. And it has now been another 60 years since we have been able to develop more understanding of this and the different ways and variations that the genes are expressed, to appreciate its significance in the management of and production of either health or chronic disease in midlife. The Logic of Disease chapter by Dr. Barton Childs goes on to discuss the inborn error as a central theme in medicine. We might contrast then Archibald Gerard to William Osler, who was at the same time in history considered one of the premier physicians of his age. There's a prophetic symbolism in the succession. Osler, or the Oslerian ideal, it is not easy to separate the man from the myth, dominated medicine in his time as few have done ever since. And in large degree, the ideal persists to this day. The Oslerian ideal is disease is accepted as simply a matter of fact, and it is, in fact, part of the doctor's responsibility to deal with it, because there's nothing you can do about it. It is very deterministic. It is built around a Mendelian view of the gene as unmodifiable, producing then risk to disease for which the physician can only deal with the outcome, not with the difficulties. Osler's book, The Principles of Practice of Medicine, begins on page 1 with the diagnosis and treatment of typhoid fever. There is no preliminary discussion of the nature of the disease, of who is likely to be sick, who escapes, or why anyone would ever be sick at all. Indeed, it would have been thought eccentric to have started the book in any such way. And from that has been the wellspring of medical education, that disease is something that afflicts a person, that its principal responsibility of the doctor is to treat the disease, and its etiology is both of only esoteric interest and little clinical importance in how a physician should move towards treatment. Obviously, that's changing now. It's changing dramatically as what Dr. Childs calls the Gerard resurgence, because now Gerardism, or the molecular basis of disease, is starting to reoccur as an explanation for why people in midlife get ill. Not a single vector producing a signal disease like pneumonia or smallpox or diphtheria or typhoid, but rather a complex interwoven web of interaction between the person's genes, exposure to agents that could be considered triggers, and then the response of those genes to those triggers to give rise to mediators, signs, and symptoms. So I thank Dr. Barton Charles for an extraordinary contribution to our education as it relates to the historical evolution of the explanation of disease, and how functional medicine, which looks at the genetic underpinning and the agents and influences from the environment that modify expression, can help us to understand that ultimate pathology is a result in the midlife individual of a series of different changes in function that have occurred over many years that ultimately arrive at pathology. Well, with all of that in mind, let's now talk about the theme of this month's Functional Medicine Update, which is cognitive dysfunction in children. And it's really interesting when we start talking about that, because there's still the belief in many quarters that genes determine cognitive function, and it's just the luck of the genetic draw. I was very intrigued when I saw the recent Scientific American May 1998 article entitled "The Genetics of Cognitive Abilities and Disabilities," in which they go on to say it would be reasonable to think that the environment is the sole source of differences in cognitive skills. That is what we learn. And then they go on to say, but just how much do genes and environment intermix to give rise to specific cognitive abilities, such as vocabulary or mathematical skills? The Why Family Study of Cognition was a collaborative project between researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder and the University of Hawaii, and involved more than 1,000 families and sibling pairs. The Why study showed that family members are in fact more alike than unrelated individuals on measures of specific cognitive skills. This suggests there is a strong genetic underpinning. But in fact, it doesn't lead us to the conclusion that cognitive ability is Mendelianly deterministic. Correlations for identical twins greatly exceed those for fraternal twins on tests of both verbal and spatial abilities in children, adolescents, and adults. Even in animal studies, there is a strong correlation between the genes of the animal and their ability to affect successful completion of maze and other spatial tests, suggesting genetic influence on cognitive function. Genetic influence on school achievement has also been found in twin studies of elementary school-aged children, as well as in the Colorado Adoption Project. The results are surprising in and of themselves, as educators have long believed that achievement is more profound effect of the effort in the educational system than the ability of the child from their genetic determinants. So we get in this age-old debate when we start talking about this, about genes and environment, deterministic or environmental self-regulatory. And of course, the answer that we come to, I think, is the same answer that has been derived in the last 50 years as this discussion has occurred in many quarters of medicine and politics and sociology, and that is, it's a mixture of genes and environment. Children with reading disability, known as dyslexia, are well known to have difficulty comprehending and reading out loud. Studies by a variety of investigators, including DeFries, have shown that reading disability runs in families, and the genetic factors do indeed contribute to the resemblance among family members. The identical twin of a person diagnosed with reading disability, for example, has a 68% risk of being similarly diagnosed, whereas a fraternal twin has a 38% chance, again leading some people to conclude that this must mean that cognitive ability is genetically determined. Research in mice and fruit flies have succeeded in identifying single genes related to learning and spatial perception, and investigations of naturally occurring variations in human populations have found mutations in single genes that do result in general mental retardation. But generally, these are considered the frank genetic metabolism diseases like phenylketonuria or Fragile X syndrome. The most important part of the story, however, is that normal cognitive function is almost certainly orchestrated by many subtly acting genes working together rather than by single genes operating in isolation. These collaborative genes are thought to affect cognition in a probabilistic rather than deterministic manner and are called quantitative trait loci. In the parlance of the geneticists, these are abbreviated as QTLs, quantitative trait loci. The name, which implies to genes that are involved in complex dimensions such as cognition, emphasizes the quantitative nature of certain physical and behavioral traits. QTLs have already been identified for diseases such as diabetes, obesity, and hypertension, as well as behavioral problems involving drug sensitivity and dependence. The authors of the Scientific American article go on to say, and I think this is the important takeaway for us in terms of functional medicine, which, as you know, is the focus on the improvement of physiological, cognitive, emotional, and physical functioning. That the discovery of genes for disorders and disabilities will also help clinicians design more effective therapies and to identify people at risk before the appearance of symptoms. We've talked about, in fact, the APOE4 gene characteristic, which may encode for increased risk to dementia and cognitive decline in the elderly, for which if you know that you carry that APOE4 genotype, that you can start practicing the right things earlier in life to prevent the expression of that characteristic that is associated with more premature decline in central nervous system function. The authors close by saying, "We cannot emphasize too much that genetic effects do not imply genetic determinism, nor do they constrain environmental interventions." I think this is a very important takeaway from the story that we are really trying to relate in this month's Functional Medicine Update. Yes, we are all given our genetic blueprint, our roadmap. But within that roadmap are many different routes of travel. The routes of travel that we select to take will in part depend upon those decisions that we make and also in how we live, act, feel, believe, and reinforce the life experience. Do we select to eat the right foods, think the right thoughts, live in an unpolluted environment, stay away from toxic substances, get regular activity? These are the things that James Freeze talked about in his classic paper that we've described numerous times in Functional Medicine Update about compression of morbidity and prolongation of life and health span that are associated with the practicing of characteristics that lead to good gene expression. Now, obviously, there are those individuals who happen by the luck of the draw to be born with genetic characteristics that are more likely to be maladapted to our environment than others. Certainly with children with genetic metabolism disorders, this is the case. As you know, there are many children who do have, early on in life, the appearance of molecular disorders that express themselves as central nervous system defects. But even in those mutant cases where there is some mutation or some complex array of mutations that gives rise to suboptimal brain function, many of these are modifiable in their phenotype by only learning how to practice the right things. And practice may be the right biochemical environment, as Dr. Pauling and Hoffer talked about years ago, orthomolecular environment for the mind, or it may have to do with the right patterning, so as the individual can use their plasticity of neuronal function to move beyond that of the blocking characteristic of their genes to improve their phenotype. Well, let me give you one such example. This is an example of a 10-year-old young lady who had seizure disorders and a serious cognitive difficulty, unable to speak, had spasticity of the muscles, at 10 had not grown, was short and developmentally retarded. And the parents obviously had spent great time and energy and anguish in trying to assist their daughter. Just recently, she had a analysis done of both plasma and urine, organic acids, amino acids, and other metabolites. This particular multi-analyte profile was done to try to see if there was a pattern of dysfunctional metabolism that could associate itself with the central nervous system problems that she was expressing. One might assume, on the basis of the severe difficulties that this child was having, that she had a frank genetic metabolism disorder that was unmodifiable, i.e., genes that were broken. Or one could assume that, yes, her genes were producing an outcome in her phenotype which were suboptimal, but there may be other routes of escape from this if we can only open up the right pass, if we can only unblock the roadblocks. Well, examining her multi-analyte profile, there are some things that looked very interesting. Her lactic acid levels were elevated in the urine. Her pyruvate levels were marginally elevated, suggesting extra mitochondrial anaerobic glycolysis was how her body was trying to produce enough energy to maintain function. This may indicate a mitochondrial disorder. A muscle biopsy, however, did not show any frank mitochondrial mutations, so this might be a conditional mitochondrial disorder caused by other events that could poison mitochondria or uncouple mitochondrial function, recalling that the places where mitochondrial function are most important are places that are involved with very active glycolysis and oxygen utilization, such as the brain and the heart and the liver and the white blood cells and the gastrointestinal mucosa. So she was demonstrating lactic acidosis of a marginal kind of a chronic state. She also had some other interesting aberrations in her profile. Elevation in Krebs cycle intermediates of cis-aconitate and citrate, which demonstrate or at least suggest strongly blocks in the Krebs cycle. Again, markers for mitochondrial function. Some of us recall that upregulation of nitric oxide production due to immune dysfunction or immune upregulation can then uncouple neuronal Krebs cycle activity in the mitochondria, and in so doing causes a elevation of citrate and cis-aconitate, because that nitric oxide uncoupling occurs at the enzyme step cis-aconitase. And therefore she was showing the lactic acidosis of mitochondrial interruption, she was showing the uncoupling of Krebs cycle activity, and that the blockage appeared to occur at the point related to cis-aconitase activity, which is implicating excessive nitric oxide output from the glial or the microglia. Nitric oxide, as you know, comes as a consequence of the stimulation of the immune cells, and in the brain, that's the microglia, to be in an immune-activated state. The pro-inflammatory cytokines can initiate the upregulation of the expression of inducible form of nitric oxide synthase, converting then in these cells arginine to nitric oxide, which then subsequently, by diffusion-controlled reaction, travels rapidly across the mitochondrial membrane of an adjacent cell and can uncouple its mitochondria, in so doing, produce mitochondrial suicide or oxidative stress. So there's some evidence that this girl was experiencing what might be called mitochondrial toxicity, mitochondrial uncoupling. It did not appear to be a consequence of an inherited mitochondrial mutation, but rather something else was possibly contributing to this. Well, looking at some of the other analytes in her multi-analyte profile, it was found that there was some evidence for bacterial byproducts that might be elevated, metabolites from various types of organisms that could, in fact, influence glial cell activity and nitric oxide output. There are also some elevation of various types of fatty acid metabolites, which indicated oxidative damage to long-chain unsaturated fatty acids, which might also contribute to these problems. So from this profile, one recognizes that, gee, there is evidence that possibly there's an induced mitochondrial dysfunction, energy deficiency in the central nervous system, increased oxidative stress, a feed-forward mechanism of being locked into a loop of damage. And therefore, how do you break that loop? Well, first of all, you want to try to quell or quench the excessive oxidative production within mitochondria that are uncoupled. And so one thinks about coenzyme Q10, and one thinks about vitamin E and lipoic acid and N-acetyl carnitine and N-acetyl cysteine. And generally the doses that are given in these cases because of the increased level of oxidant stress are beyond that which you would give for normal maintenance. They're more therapeutic. And in fact, as you know, Drs. Wallace and Schaffner at the Center for Molecular Diseases in Emory Medical School have treated children with MELOS and other mitochondrial dysfunctions with very high doses of some of these electron transport regulators, 200 milligrams, for instance, of coenzyme Q10 and several thousand milligrams of sodium succinate, trying to encourage metabolism around these metabolic blocks. And so one might consider the coenzyme Q10, N-acetylcysteine, lipoic acid, N-acetyl carnitine, vitamin E administration to try to promote better mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation and Krebs cycle function. Beyond that, however, one wants to also lower the load of substances that might upregulate the immune-inducible form of nitric oxide and increase nitric oxide output and poisoning of neurons. And so you do that by looking at those offenders. Could it be a food antigenic substance? Could it be an environmental antigenic substance? Could it be a dysbiosis that produces a secondary byproduct that has effect across the blood-brain barrier on microglial activity? Could it be a parasitic organism that has an effect then upon the systemic immune production of things like pro-inflammatory cytokines that then have their influence across the blood-brain barrier? Looking at web-like interconnection among the gut and the liver and the brain, and ultimately on neuronal function. Well, the exciting thing about this story is that in using this logic, by putting the young lady on a diet that was oligoantigenic, by re-culturing the gut with the appropriate bacteria with the so-called 4R program, remove, replace, re-inoculate, repair, and by utilizing higher doses of these Krebs cycle modulating nutrients that help to reduce oxidative stress in mitochondria, her function started to improve very, very rapidly. In fact, she started to be able to communicate for the first time at age of 10. Her muscle spasticity was significantly reduced, and her overall function and quality of life, if I can use that term advisedly, was markedly improved. Now, was she a normal, active, fully ranging 10-year-old? The answer is no. But had she achieved considerable improvement over what we might have thought her genes locked her into as her status of living? And the answer is yes. Incredible improvement in function. So here's an example, I think, probably at one end of the extreme of the continuum of a situation where you have genetic susceptibility coupled with environmental dysregulation that then produces a phenotype of neuronal injury. By the way, I should mention that an important part of this story is the initial damage to this child's nervous system occurred in infancy when she had viral encephalitis, and therefore she had sustained a viral inflammation of her brain, which locked in this feed-forward mechanism of immune upregulation and neuronal damage due to mitochondrial uncoupling. So by trying to break that loop, by taking the load off the size of immune activation, and by increasing then the buttressing effects of antioxidants and Krebs cycle supportive nutrients and mitochondrial protection, the balance between function and dysfunction can be moved back towards the functional state. I think that's a very exciting application of this model of the Archibald Garrod, Linus Pauling concepts of molecular medicine. Well, you know that one of the most common defects that we see in children who go on to have brain chemical disturbances in infancy or in youth are amino acid-related dysfunctions, because they cannot properly metabolize through transamination and Krebs cycle oxidation of various carbon skeletons related to the amino acid families. I was very pleased to see a recent paper in Clinical Chemistry, Volume 43, page 2397 in 1997, talking about age-specific distribution patterns of plasma amino acid concentrations in pediatric populations. The reason this is important is that in the past we haven't had very good data as to know what deviation from a healthy population of differing aged infants and children can relate then to amino acidurias that can produce chronic symptoms and dysfunctions. In this particular study, they looked at children ranging from 0 to 18 years of age. They evaluated 23 plasma-free amino acids in 148 presumably healthy children, and then they tried to look at the age distribution of these amino acid profiles. 9 amino acids, including alanine and arginine, asparagine, methionine, ornithine, phenylalanine, proline, threonine, and tyrosine. So there are several essential amino acids in that list, including phenylalanine / tyrosine and threonine, as well as methionine, demonstrated a decrease in their concentration during the first year of life, which may indicate they're being used for the construction of new body tissue and part of the pool of active essential amino acids from which new proteins will be synthesized. 5 amino acids, which include aspartic acid, citrulline, glutamic acid, serine, and taurine, did not follow these common profiles, nor did cysteine, glutamate, glycine, histidine, isoleucine, leucine, lysine, tryptophan, and valine, which actually had a steady increase during infancy as they moved into later childhood. The point I'm trying to make here is that we certainly see the utility of amino acid profiling, as well as fatty acid profiling and organic acid profiling, for trying to understand better in children some of these metabolic defects that are producing neurologic or immunologic dysfunctions. in utilizing amino acid patterns, we certainly want to make sure we look at age-adjusted patterns, because obviously there are changes in the plasma level of these amino acids as a child goes from infancy into adolescence. And by using the right reference range, we're better able to then see where pattern dysfunctions might result, from which we then can design specific programs, nutritional intervention or therapeutic pharmacological nutrition programs, to try to help balance these amino acid dysfunctions. Remember, the amino acids are reflective of broader issues pertaining to energy economy, mitochondrial function, and basic metabolism. The amino aciduras are often a consequence of the downstream effects from the poor metabolism of specific amino acids that then produce buildup of carbon skeletons, or the organic acids from these amino acids, like alpha-ketoglutaric acid or valeric acid, which can then produce symptoms of dysfunction. So we might look at amino acids and fatty acids and organic acids as a three sets of data that help us to understand defects in metabolism that may not be just the frank inborn errors of genetic metabolism diseases, but functional errors in metabolism that produce dysfunction in behavior, brain chemistry, or immune function. Well, going on one more step, we might ask the question, we've talked a lot about biochemistry and its impact upon function. What about the environment? What about enriching a child's intelligence and neuronal patterning as a consequence of the things that happen to them in their environment? And this is a very important part of the balance and the integration of functional medicine. Dr. Marion Cleaves Diamond, a professor of integrative biology at the University of California at Berkeley, was a presenter at our third international symposium in functional medicine in Vancouver, British Columbia. Her talk, entitled Beyond Heredity, Maximizing Nervous System Function, was an extraordinary talk and derived out of her nearly 30 years of research in animals, showing that by enriching their environment, by having them stimulated intellectually and challenged, that you can actually observe dendritic branching and increased synaptic function and thickening of the cortex in animals when they are in an enriched environment. A deprived environment does the opposite. It results in a deprivation of neuronal function, neuronal reserve. This is a classic example of improving organ reserve by enriching the environment. Her book, entitled Beyond Heredity, is a classic book, a 1988 publication describing the results of her and many other collaborators' research showing this improved actual physiology of the brain and anatomy of the brain as a consequence of stimulation. So we're really talking here not just about biochemistry alone and the molecular environment, but we're also talking about the functional environment. This is obviously the underpinning of what the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential has done for nearly 50 years, with Glenn Doman as its founder. Mr. Doman, as you know, was the recipient of the first International Linus Pauling Award on Functional Medicine, a well-deserved recipient of that award for the extraordinary work he and his colleagues have done at the Institutes over these many decades in helping to develop patterning programs and enrichment programs for children with various types of brain biochemical and behavioral and physiological, physical dysfunctions that many of these children might have been considered relegated to this level of dysfunction throughout all of their life, but rather with the Institute's program have achieved a tremendous function as they move into adulthood by practicing the right things, by patterning, using neuronal plasticity to the advantage of the child in their development, enriching intelligence. This is the basis of a very fascinating review article that recently appeared in the Annual Review of Neuroscience, Volume 20, Page 1, in which the investigators from the Department of Neuroscience at the Robert Wood Johnson Medical School and the Department of Physical Therapy at Temple University Medical School have discussed patterning and the specification of the effects it has on the cerebral cortex and the development of cerebral cortical function. For those who want to tie together mechanistic neurobiology and neurophysiology with observed clinical outcome in people's function, this paper probably does it as well as any I've ever seen, because it really does detailed review of neuroanatomy and neurophysiology and how patterning can result in specific improvements in cerebral cortical function. They close this article, however, saying something very powerful, and I think it's the message of this tape. It says, because cortical and thalamic expansion do not occur in parallel, precision and organization and stabilization of the new regions of the cortex are more likely to rely on late developmental signals that arise from active inputs, end quote. Therefore, practicing the right things, being involved with an enriched environment, the right molecular environment, and not seeing these disturbances as Mendelianly locked and fixed in place, rigid and deterministic, is to me a threshold for the new medicine. This introduction takes us beautifully into side two of this month's Functional Medicine Update with our clinician of the month, who will be speaking from his experience both as a researcher and as a clinician in how these, what might appear to be esoteric concepts, really relate to improved function in children who have experienced difficulties in school or who have been labeled as ADHD children, for whom the approach towards their improved function might be the integration of cortical stimulation, i.e. the enriched environment, and the proper molecular milieu that produces then the opportunity for their genes to be fully expressed. This is what functional medicine is all about at the clinical applied level. We're once again very pleased to have as our clinician of the month someone that will bring to you a lot of information related to how functional medicine plays out both in the research and clinical mode, Dr. Michael Lyon. Dr. Lyon is a physician on Vancouver Island in British Columbia, Canada, educated in Calgary in Canada and has a medical degree taken there. He has a very rich resume of extraordinary number of experiences, including, but certainly not limited to, his work as the chief medical overseer of the Canadian national bobsled team and their work in the Olympics and his pursuit of drug-free sports and how that interrelated to enhancing sports performance using appropriate nutrition and health promotion concepts. And he has also been very actively involved in the development and application of the functional medicine model in the research institution that he heads, which is the Oceanside Functional Medicine Research Institute in Nanaimo, British Columbia, Canada. In this capacity, Dr. Lyon has overseen and developed research that looks at the application of functional medicine and interfaces with the clinician and other staff at the center there that actually sees patients who are on various functional medicine programs. So it's a nice hybridization between the research element and the clinical applications. We have a real authority to share with us some of his experiences with the application of functional medicine. And Dr. Lyon, we really welcome you to Functional Medicine Update. And the first thing we need to say is how pleased we are that you have chosen the term Functional Medicine Research Institute as the focus and direction in your particular studies. One of the things that you're doing, I know, is looking at attention disorder, hyperactivity disorder, or ADHD in children. And it might be said by some that, gee, this seems like a far stretch from functional medicine to be studying ADHD with a functional medicine model. Can you describe to us how they fit together and what led you into this kind of research?
Well, I think that the conventional world, the majority of the medical realm considers attention deficit disorder to be virtually genetic and kind of a stamp upon the child where there's really nothing one can do other than to markedly and rapidly alter their brain metabolism through some sort of powerful drug. But I think most of us at the gut level, as well as those of us who've been pursuing nutritional medicine and functional medicine, realize that there's always something deeper. There's always a antecedent factor or factors that lead to the changes that we see manifest as definable diseases. So our interest in attention deficit disorder was to try to look at children from a functional medicine point of view and try to define what are those antecedents and triggers that eventually lead to a highly disruptive child or a child that has a terribly poor prognosis in their future. In fact, many people who are in this field suggest that these children have often elements of brilliance and they can often be tapped as being prodigies or kids with tremendous creative capabilities. And why should these kids be burdened with some sort of label that also is accompanied by a terrible prognosis? So this was our motivation, and we weren't the first to look at this to some extent, but we feel that we've had a look at the children's underlying physiology in perhaps a more thorough way than's been done before.
Could you tell us a little bit about your study? I know it's been a really intensive and extensive study involving proper patient selection and proper evaluation and kind of looking at this from a web-like functional perspective rather than just a single contributor to the condition.
Well, we started by selecting children from the community that had classical attention deficit disorder symptoms that would be clearly diagnosed as such. Many of these kids were on drugs or had been on drugs in the past. These were kids who had parents that were potentially interested in looking deeper into the problem rather than just having their kids on drugs. So So we had a pretty normal selection of kids with attention deficit disorder. Then we divided the group into three randomly, and a third of the kids went into a control group, and two-thirds of the kids went into a group where we had the parents come to weekly classes and have them alter their nutrition in various ways, which I'll get into a bit later. Now, before we actually had any intervention with these kids, we had them supply us with blood, urine, and stool samples, and we tested them in numerous ways to try to look at underlying physiological factors that might be a part of their condition. So, for instance, we looked at their essential fatty acid blood profile and tried to determine whether this was a factor in their condition. We did the comprehensive digestive and stool analysis with parasites to see if these kids had dysbiosis or had suggestions that there was some immune impairment or had problems with poor digestion. We also did the intestinal permeability test to see if these kids had a leaky gut or problems with absorption. And so we did a number of these types of tests. And again, the goal was to see if there was something functionally impairing these kids that would be antecedent to the actual neurological problem leading to their behavioral or attentional problems.
You mentioned the groups that you randomized the children to, and I think you only got into the first group. What about the other two groups of children?
Well, we had the control group, no intervention. We had the two other groups that the parents attended weekly classes where we quite intensively helped them to get their kids off junk food, to identify and remove potential or likely food allergens in their diet. We taught parents principles of good nutrition and tried to just get them really motivated through the use of potluck dinners once a week where they would bring in some select recipes and so on. Now, in the two groups that were going to the classes, there was also half of that group that were randomly selected to get a medical food product, which is UltraCare for Kids, which has a number of substances in there that are targeted for children that have atopic disorders or who have attention deficit disorder. And the desire was to compare dietary intervention alone using elimination diet, a modified elimination diet, as I've described, as compared with the elimination diet combined with this medical food product. And as we know from our experience with the UltraClear products, that these medical food products in some cases can make an enormous world of difference. And so we are really wanting to have a close look at what this did in these kids.
When you look at essential fatty acid profiles in these children, did you find any kinds of alterations in the three omega-3, 9, or 6 families relative to what had been observed in some of the previous published studies?
Yes, in fact, our samples that we received back were a little bit surprising. In the past, there have been suggestions that these kids probably have some impairment of their delta-6 desaturase enzyme activity, and thus they would have uniform lack of their long-chain omega-3 and omega-6 essential fatty acids, GLA, DGLA, in the omega-6 region, maybe arachidonic acid. Then in the omega-3, the DHA and EPA. But in fact, what we found was very few of these kids had any deficiencies in the omega-6. They actually had very high levels of the basic starting point, the linoleic acid, in most cases. And they had almost uniformly across the board low levels of DHA, particularly. So it looks like these kids may be selectively impairing their delta-6 desaturase, and it may be because they're receiving so much omega-6 in their diet that it's essentially sort of shunting it towards that direction rather than, you know, there's just not enough precursor to make the omega-3. So it supports the notion that DHA is probably the one that you want to give these kids if you're going to give them fatty acid supplements.
And how about the gut biosis indicator and the gut permeability studies? Did you find anything of significance from those results?
Yes, about 75% of the kids had very clearly a leaky gut, so-called, or increased gut permeability, where their lactulose to mannitol ratio was quite elevated. The cause of this, of course, you've got to dig deeper to find out why, but I think based on what we found with the response to the diet, that the majority of these kids have a leaky gut because they have food allergies and sensitivities, combined with real marked dysbiosis. What we found in the comprehensive digestive and stool analysis is these kids had real marked dysbiosis. About 65% had intestinal protozoal parasites, some as many as 4 different parasites in one child. They also, about a third of them, had very heavy growth of candida yeast, and then there were heavy growths found of various potentially parasitic bacteria like Klebsiella, Proteus, and so on. Very, very few of these kids had high amounts of the desirable flora, the Acidophilus or Bifidus bacteria. So So it really, across the board, looked like these kids had real significant dysbiosis and could benefit by virtually an intensive 4R program. Now, of course, what we did in terms of the 4R program was we removed one of the major things to remove, which is food allergens. Hopefully, the diet that we selected removed potential food allergens from these kids' diets. And then we added FOS, fructooligosaccharides, which would be down the list in the 4R program in the replace with something that would be considered to be prebiotic, the fructooligosaccharides being a carbohydrate that helps to nourish desirable gut flora. Now we're just waiting. We've gathered the final samples. I can't tell you what we found in terms of our interventions with the testing now and follow-up. We're anxiously awaiting the follow-up results to see what we have accomplished with our intervention.
You talked a lot about the prevalence of dysbiosis and gut permeability changes in the ADHD children. How about in the control group? Was there a difference between the two groups in the prevalence of those conditions?
No, we virtually saw the same kinds of problems in all kids across the board. We did our randomization to select who went to which group, and it appears that our randomization worked. We had quite a nice even distribution of the kinds of test results that we found amongst the three groups.
That's very interesting. Have you noted any parental qualitative comments concerning subjective improvements in the children in one group versus another, or is too premature to say if there's any difference?
No, not at all too premature. In fact, we've had a number of parents. I would say in the intervention groups where they had dietary change, we have seen at least 2/3 to 3/4 of the parents absolutely astounded. And I don't use that word lightly, because we've seen parents just that have been beside themselves, not knowing what to do, just desperate to help these kids, now reporting that their kids are just remarkably improved, that the changes have been quite astounding. In fact, this morning we have a child who is giving a presentation to his school. This was a kid who was extremely bright, but just could not stop being disruptive in class. He spent most of his day down at the school principal's office, and today he's giving a presentation to his class to explain why he's such a different boy. He's such a bright boy that he's able to stand up and, I guess, articulate like a little politician. He's only about 10 years old, but apparently the school is coming to listen to what's happened to him, and the school principal, the teachers, they're just amazed at the results that he's obtained by dietary change and being on this medical food product. So we have had a number of reports like that where the results have been so significant that the parents are wanting to start support groups in the city to continue this momentum going. They are, you know, they're wanting to contact the media to discuss what's going on, and it's really been quite exciting, and a lot more came out of it than we really expected, even so far, without even having the lab results back. And on the other hand, what we noticed when we had the kids back for their blood testing, that was sort of a good test at the beginning to see how disruptive these kids were and how difficult they were, because it was pretty tough to draw the blood on these kids when they first came in, being that they were, you know, attention deficit disorder kids, and some of them had a defiant disorder on top of that. Basically, what we found was uniformly, and it's quite strange, but not one single child in the intervention groups gave us any trouble at all drawing the blood in follow-up, whereas in the control group, we had to have as many as 4 people holding these kids down with screaming and hollering and the whole business. Only amongst the control group when we were retesting them in follow-up. So that was one observation that all the staff made, and we found quite interesting that uniformly the kids in the intervention group were fine as far as getting their blood redrawn. So maybe that's an interesting test we can add to the list of tests for attention deficit disorder. Who knows?
It sounds like a credible and neurological stress test.
It's a stress test, that's for sure.
Let me summarize and just to make sure that I got it right as to what you've just presented. You recruited a group of ADHD children with parental consent, and you broke them into 3 groups, a control group of ADHD kids that did not get any specific intervention therapy. The other 2 groups got diet classes and an elimination diet, and one of those other 2 groups got a medical food product as well as the elimination diet and diet counseling. You followed in all the groups, the control, the diet plus medical food, the diet only, the gut biosis indicators, permeability, and essential fatty acids before and after a period of intervention. And you have not yet received back the results from the intervention lab data, but the qualitative signs indicate a marked performance improvement in these children who had the diet and then the diet plus medical food as contrasted to the control group. Is that an accurate summary of what you've just told us?
Yes, that's a good summary. I should have mentioned that in addition to just parental observation, we have gathered some qualitative data based on the Connors screening questionnaires. There's very acceptable form that one can fill out. It's about 80 questions, or rather parents fill out or teachers fill out. And these are forms that rate the child's attention deficit disorder symptoms. So it's a good way of going beyond the anecdote to getting some actual quantitative data about the child's behavior. And we had the parents and teachers fill out these forms prior to starting the study and then now afterwards. We don't have our statistical data yet on this, but I have looked at quite a number of the before and after Connors tests that have come back in, and it's quite clear that the kids in the intervention group, some of them have had remarkable improvements on their Connors scores.
This is very, very exciting, and obviously we're still in the preliminary stage of your evaluation of the information, but certainly is very encouraging, and it seems to follow nicely from the model that you have been pursuing for some years at your research there at the Oceanside Functional Medicine Research Institute, and it surrounds toxicity and detoxification, an area that we were very privileged to have you present at the on-site applied functional medicine and clinical practice teaching session for the clinicians here in Gig Harbor, Washington a few months ago. Could you tell us a little bit about your overview as it relates to detoxification and toxicity? It seems like this is one application of it in a wider range of potential implications.
Well, yes. In fact, one of the reasons why we're very interested in attention deficit disorder is we believe there's a very strong common link between attention deficit disorder and the kinds of functional disorders that individuals can experience later in their life. One of the clues that led us to believe this was when we were doing an attention deficit disorder study last summer on adults with attention deficit disorder. We found a very high incidence of fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome amongst the adults with attention deficit disorder. And when we started testing these adults, we found that, in fact, they had many of the same features that we were thinking would quite likely be present in these kids, and now we've confirmed with these functional tests we've done on these kids. So it may be that we're seeing a manifestation of the same toxicological problem simply at a different age. Children that have even a prenatal exposure during uterine development to environmental toxicants, mercury from the mother's amalgams, various organochlorines, lead from the environment of the mother, cigarette smoking, etc., and then the child that's born into a toxic environment, perhaps with some sort of genetic predisposition in some case, but basically the toxicology is likely where all this originates from in the first place. It's probably our real primary antecedent that is common between chronic fatigue and attention deficit disorder. So we have been pursuing, in terms of chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, work looking at the toxicology of those disorders, and have found a tremendous amount of data to support that these disorders indeed are really arising from a toxicology problem. One of the next phases in our research in attention deficit disorders, we intend to look at the toxicology of attention deficit disorder much more thoroughly. Some have looked at it in a cursory sort of way where they've done blood lead levels and so on, but it would be nice to get some sort of broad range of assessment of the toxicological stress on these kids compared to non-affected kids.
This is very interesting because it was not too many years ago in Functional Medicine Update that we had an extensive discussion about the first signs of chronic toxicity being seen as neurotoxicology and immunotoxicological impacts. And it seems like a lot of that is what you might be seeing both in your children and adult patients that you've studied, showing chronic neurological and immunological alterations.
Yes, I think there's two common features of the nervous system and the immune system. One is that they're highly sensitive. They're sensitive to oxidative stress, and they're sensitive to xenobiotic influence. And secondly, that they both have very, very powerful memory, and that plays itself out in many different ways. Individuals that have xenobiotic exposure, their immune system never forgets, so they become potentially increasingly sensitized to these things as their immune system builds memory against these things, either antigenic memory or some other more mysterious memory we don't quite understand. The classical studies of the rats given some sort of poison and given a sniff of camphor at the same time, and then later on the rats just get a sniff of camphor and they virtually have some sort of serum sickness or have some sort of autoimmune crisis from just having a little sniff of camphor, because their immune system associates the camphor with the poison and their immune system never forgets. You know, we're at the threshold of discovering that our immune systems and our nervous systems are far more sensitive than we ever figured, and we've been playing with our immune systems and our nervous systems with this environment we live in, and really little regard for the things that we expose ourselves to all the time. But the time is coming when these disorders, like attention deficit disorder, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, they're going to literally begin to put such a stress on our society that we'll have to look at this from a toxicological point of view, or our whole society, I think, is greatly threatened.
I remember about 1975, 1976, Dr. Philip Needleman authored a paper that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine that was describing the relationship between the level of lead in the dentin of deciduous teeth of school kids in the Boston metropolitan area and the relationship to their IQ. And he pointed out that children who had high lead dentin levels in their deciduous teeth were kids who had lowered attention span as measured with a certain little test that they had used, a game the kids had to play. And the difference in the ability to stay at task for the kids with the high lead, which was a very short ability to stay at task, versus the kids with the low lead levels, that was a much longer time that they could stay at task, led him to conclude that possibly children in the school system who had lead, even chronic lead exposure and body burden, may have impaired cognitive function, which is acted out in the school system as an attention disorder or as a behavior disorder, and ends up in the wrong place in the school counselor's office rather than looking at it as a toxic burden to their nervous system. He followed that up with extensive studies looking at the effect of lead on IQ, and was pretty much vilified, as I recall, for about 15 years for this position, but now has pretty much, I think, been exonerated for being a leader in our understanding of the role that toxic metals, lead being one, but cadmium, mercury being others, could have on the nervous system. Have you looked at these toxic metal contributions as well?
Yes, I followed Dr. Needleman's work very closely, and many others now in this field. I was quite pleased when I saw that the levels that were considered to be lead toxic in the blood of children were lowered to 10 micrograms per deciliter from, I think it was originally 50. This has taken us a long ways into an understanding and a recognition of the impact of very low levels of some of these toxicants on our children, but we still don't recognize two things. We don't realize that we share the same neurons as our children, and we also are susceptible to very low levels of some of these toxicants. And also, perhaps even more significantly, that there's a tremendous synergy between the thousands of chemicals that we're exposed to. It isn't just the 10 micrograms per deciliter of lead. It's also the mercury, the cadmium, the arsenic, the PCBs, the other organochlorines, the solvent residues, the other petrochemical residues, the organophosphate pesticide residues, on and on and on and on. All these things working together in a kind of evil synergy within ourselves. It's really quite a leap to go from saying 10 micrograms per deciliter of lead in blood is the magic factor to saying that one day we'll analyze 10 or 15,000 different chemicals and be able to determine who's really neurotoxicologically affected. But that's the area we have to be striving towards, is some way of measuring who's really neurotoxicologically impaired or whose immune system is impaired by the synergy between all these different chemicals. And not only the level of these things, but the injuries that they've left behind. It's very complex, but that's where I think we're going to get our biggest bang for the buck, so to speak, in terms of treating chronic illness, is looking at it from a toxicology point of view.
Last month, our clinician of the month was Dr. Jeffrey Akoppelson, who has been utilizing secretin or secretin in the management of autism in children, along with a number of other physicians who have had positive response with it as well. And he talked about the work of Dr. William Shaw and Dr. Sidney Baker and Dr. Bernard Rimlin, who have all been looking at autism as potentially a result of auto-intoxication from the development of certain kinds of neurotoxic chemicals that deliver to the brain specific brain biochemical modulating effects. He actually went on to postulate that the reason that the secretin might be working is it might result in improved integrity of the GI mucosa, thereby helping the child to defend themselves against the auto-intoxication from some gut-derived substances that influence brain chemistry. From your experience, do you think the work that you're doing with ADHD is part of a general sequelae and series of severities of different neurological problems associated with toxicity that are seen with different genetic susceptibilities in different age individuals?
Yes, I have little doubt of that, and I'm glad you mentioned the work of Bernie Rimland and Dr. Shaw and so on, because we don't have any of these results back yet, but we did send the urine to Dr. Shaw for analysis for organic substances, gut-derived organic acids. on top of the toxicology that we talked about before from the environment. As you mentioned, the secretin work that's been done on the kids with autism suggests that when you give these kids secretin, that the levels of gut-derived toxins can go down quite remarkably. They have been following organic acids in these kids and finding that some of the very toxic organic acids that are gut-derived from microbial metabolism, following even one or two injections with secretin, and these toxic levels can go way down in these kids, suggesting that there is, firstly, a significant gastrointestinal impairment in these kids. Primarily, their immune system and their gut is remarkably impaired, allowing the overgrowth of organisms that are potentially highly toxic, and that there is some sort of potential for something like secretin to reset probably some sort of rhythm of the immune system that allows the gut mucosa to heal and that allows the immune system, the secretory IgA, to come back online. It's almost potentially like rebooting a computer. So I think all of these things are pieces of a puzzle. If we step back now, even with the data that we have, and say if you look at a child and you improve their nutrition overall, you remove potential food allergens from their diet, you help to remove environmental toxins from their environment, from their bodies by improving their nutrition, if you add essential fatty acids in a very targeted kind of way, if you work with these kids behaviorally and educationally, you do all these things as pieces of a puzzle, I think even now the majority of these kids can be remarkably helped. It just takes education of the parents, it takes clinicians that are very much aware of the whole picture, where we're at right now, and I think that we can see really astounding results in the majority of these kids.
Well, Dr. Lyon, I really want to thank you. That's a very optimistic and uplifting close from what was a fascinating description of the research that you were overseeing there at the Oceanside Functional Medicine Research Institute with ADHD children. We'd like to stop back in and visit with you after your results are finalized and hear kind of the final conclusion. It sounds very reminiscent to me of an interview we had a number of years ago with Dr. Nizzulli at Georgetown University Medical School, who was describing his research work on children who had recurrent serous otitis media, in which he had been able to, by removing foods to which these children were sensitive, reduce the recurrence of middle ear infections by as much as 80% in these kids, which was certainly a counterintuitive view as to how pediatricians have previously thought of this condition as more a bacterial infection required amoxicillin or other antibiotic therapy. So it sounds like we're emerging a much more functional view of some of these pediatric complex health problems and showing that functional medicine cuts across a wide variety of ages. So thank you so much for your hard work and sharing it with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
For those of you that might want to follow up with Dr. Lyon's comments and learn more about the clinical study that he is involved with at the Oceanside Functional Medicine Research Institute on ADHD children, the address there is number 203-1808 Bowen Road, B-O-W-E-N Road, Nanaimo, that's N-A-N-A-I-M-O, British Columbia, Canada, V, like in Victory, 9S5W4. And the phone number there is 250-753-3030, fax 250-753-3006. And we will be putting those numbers and address on our summary cards at the end of the session. We're often confronted with the debate that appears within the field of healthcare and the changing paradigm of medicine as to why any rational, well-educated, well-informed, and well-trained individual would support nutritional supplementation in cases where the person does not present with the classic beriberi, scurvy, pellagra, xerothalmia, rickets. Why would that be justified? And as you know, there has probably been no area within medicine that has generated more ire and energy and controversy than the questions concerning micronutrient supplementation, particularly as to how American academic medicine has responded to it. It is with that in mind that I was very intrigued to see the extraordinary paper by Dr. James Goodwin and Michael Tangham in the Archives of Internal Medicine, Volume 158, page 2187 in 1998. And I want to really thank one of our close associates, Mr. Kirk Hamilton, for bringing this article to my attention, because I think it was not a day after he received it that he passed it on to me saying, this is what we have all been talking about for the past 20 years. This article is entitled Battling Quackery, Attitudes About Micronutrient Supplements in American Academic Medicine. and what the authors go on to talk about. And by the way, you might recall Dr. Goodwin's name if you've been following Preventive Medicine Update, now Functional Medicine Update, for many years. He was the author of the classic article in the Journal of the American Medical Association entitled The Tomato Effect, Rejection of Highly Efficacious Therapies, in which he described the fact that tomatoes were not consumed as foods for a long period of time because they were considered toxic because they had the doctrine of signatures of the leaves looking like devil's pitchforks, and so people thought they were the work of Satan, and they just kind of sat there, as did the potato, I might add, as well. And so sometimes our intuition is not rational, it goes on to say, and that we reject things that really do work. Well, he points out in this article on battling quackery that throughout the 20th century, American academic medicine has resisted the concept that supplements of micronutrients might have health benefits beyond the treatment of the frank nutritional deficiency diseases. This resistance was evident in several ways, the authors point out, by the uncritical acceptance of news of toxicity, such as the belief that vitamin C supplements causes kidney stones, by the angry, scornful tone used in discussions of micronutrient supplementation in the leading textbooks of medicine, and by ignoring evidence for possible efficacy of micronutrient supplements, such as the case of vitamin E for intermittent claudication. They point out that part of the resistance seemed to stem from the fact that the potential benefits of micronutrients were advanced by outsiders who took their message directly to the public rather than from the academic medical community going through the traditional sense of sieving and evaluation and peer review. And therefore, this sounds like the crime of Galileo, in which Galileo was vilified not so much because he talked about the heliocentric view of the universe. As you know, Kepler had talked about that many years earlier, and Copernicus had been going back and forth, and Copernicus actually had 70 years prior to Galileo talked about this some considerable number of writings. The difference, however, is that Copernicus wrote his work in Latin, which was not accessible to the common person. Galileo had the affront to take his message directly through the language of the people, Italian, so that everyone could understand it. And therefore, he was considered a usurper as well as a popularizer. And as a consequence, he was then vilified, whereas Copernicus, who remained as an esoteric academician, was not. The resistance is evidenced in several ways, by uncritical acceptance of bad news about micronutrient supplements, by the scornful dismissive tone of discussions about micronutrient supplements in textbooks of medicine, and by the skeptical reaction greeting any claim of efficacy of a micronutrient relative to other therapies. Indeed, most claims were just simply ignored. And therefore, because people who brought this evidence out to the public had the, I guess you would call it the affront, to take them directly to the public rather than through the potential academic review system, this subverted the traditional medical establishment and control of information. Obviously, in this day of the electronic age and the internet and the web, there is no such thing as the control of information. And so what we are seeing is much more free display of information, some of it good, some of it bad, but at least it's all out there for evaluation. Well, with that in mind, Goodwin and Tangham talk about the fact that there are extraordinary views by looking within the medical textbooks about the scornful, dismissive tone and how language that has been employed to nutritional supplementation is language that you see nowhere else in medical criticism. In Harrison's, the practice of routine use of multivitamins was condemned in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s with languaging that they say is extraordinarily unique to any kind of criticism against anything else that appeared in either Harrison's or Cecil's. And therefore, it seems that there is a stronger emotional reaction to vitamin supplements than anything that's ever been published in the medical world. Why the resistance, they say? The resistance of the medical community to the concept that scurvy, beriberi, and rickets were caused by vitamin deficiencies, as you know, took a long time to overcome. And therefore, there's been a historic adversarial position around nutrition and disease that probably is a reflection on this Osler-ism that we talked about earlier, that disease is just something that comes often from a single vector. The physician's role is to treat the disease the best they can, and these other molecular mechanisms are esoteric things for the laboratory and the research scientists that have little benefit or value in clinical practice. Well, you know, there's a lot of different spins on this. The pathologists who dominated academic medicine in the late 19th and early 20th centuries lacked the vocabulary to integrate the public health observations of vitamin deficiency into a pathophysiological model that at that time was dominated, as you know, by germ theory. This awkwardness is reminiscent of the concept of incommensurability that was put forward by Thomas Kuhn in his Structure of Scientific Revolutions. There have been previous discussions by the authors of this article, Goodwin and Tangham, that treatments that do not make sense can be rejected in favor of less effective or more toxic therapies that better fit in with the current understanding of the pathophysiology, i.e. staying within the catechism. So the conclusions of this paper are quite interesting. They go on to say in the close that there are only three important questions when evaluating a potential treatment. Does it work? What are its adverse effects? How much does it cost? Ideally, issues such as the theory underlying the treatment or the guild to which the proponents of the treatment belong should be irrelevant to the fundamental questions of efficacy, toxicity, and cost. By the way, I love the word guild. That really strikes a very powerful tone for what we're talking about. They close to say, the history of the response of academic medicine to micronutrient supplementation suggests that we have not attained that ideal, the ideal being the irrelevance of how you got there, but the questions of efficacy, toxicity, and cost being the principal determinants of decision-making. Very powerful article, and again, I want to emphasize in one of the world's most renowned medical journals. I think the thing we can say that's very supportive is it's nice to know that the world of publications is still able to accept critical reviews and publish them in the spirit of free intellectual enterprise. Well, how did we get locked into this model of don't fix it till it's broke, to use a vernacular? Well, part of it is obviously through the beauty and the success of the pharmaceutical industry with the development of antibiotics and later with corticosteroid drugs, and then later the incorporation of these concepts into medical teaching to treat these dreaded diseases, infectious diseases that are antibiotic sensitive, and to various inflammatory conditions that could respond to corticosteroid drugs. We saw an ever-increasing incorporation of prescription medication education and therapies becoming part of standard algorithms for clinical management of disease. Most of these medications, which came out after corticosteroid drugs and antibiotics, were medications that blocked, inhibited, or stopped function so that an immediate problem could be arrested. But the difficulty is we started to extend the application of these drugs into chronic situations for which then adverse drug reactions started to become more prevalent as some of the favorable effects from these functions that were blocked started to be suppressed, and now the other side of the coin was seen. It's interesting to note that in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Volume 280, page 1253, in an article entitled Prescription Drug Use and Self-Prescription Among Resident Physicians, it was found that most physicians are starting to self-prescribe medications and treat themselves in their medical school and residency. And obviously, the majority of that is antibiotics, but also medications in the allergy and gastrointestinal and analgesic and psychotropic medications and cardiovascular medications were all being employed by self-medication. So there starts to be built a nice tight system where everything is internally consistent. Symptoms, when they present, are treated with a medication which reduces the symptoms or alters the laboratory finding, which results in the ability of the person to continue to move ahead without paying attention to the molecular underpinning to why they got there in the first place, or let's call it the complex interaction of their genes and their environment, which makes them a candidate for recurrence or for re-evaluation in a different quarter with a new disease, whichever perpetuates the cost and effectiveness of the disease care delivery system. And so goes on then the recent editorial in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 339, page 1851 in 1998, under the title, Making Medicine Safer, the Need for an Independent Drug Safety Board. The authors go on to say that adverse reactions to drugs, as we pointed out earlier, are a major cause of morbidity and mortality, with over 100,000 Americans dying every year as a result of adverse reactions to hospital-administered drugs. Independent agencies exist to investigate airline accidents, railroad mishaps, and radiation spills, and to make recommendations for their prevention. However, no independent entity exists with the responsibility to monitor and investigate adverse events due to drugs, and to make recommendations to prevent them. Currently, after a drug is approved for marketing, we rely on voluntary reporting systems based upon the assumption that a drug is safe unless case reports of adverse effects call that assumption into question. It is remarkable that at a time when the technology for collecting and analyzing large amounts of data is readily available, an independent, comprehensive, and systematic program of post-marketing drug surveillance does not exist. These authors go on to then call for a post-marketing drug safety program that is independent of the agency responsible for drug approval in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, and that this needs to be established. So although the United States is now often the first country to approve new drugs as a consequence of an accelerated drug approval process, neither the FDA nor the medical community has the infrastructure to detect, investigate, and prevent these drugs' unwanted consequences. The resources of the FDA's Division of Pharmacovigilance and Epidemiology are inadequate to provide ongoing review either of the increasing number of newly approved drugs or of the almost 5,000 approved older drugs, goes on the article to say. In addition to dexflunfuramine, which has gotten a lot of press recently as a drug that's removed from the market, other major unexpected adverse side effects occurred Incad, Zomax, Celecrin, Oraflex, Seldane, and Resulin. All of these have been found to have serious adverse side effects in some individuals and have had questions related to either their routine use or even their safety. And therefore, they go on to conclude that we must expect that predicted and unpredicted adverse events from drugs will continue to occur. If we accept that the true safety profile of a new drug is dependent on the experiment that necessarily follows the drug's release into the marketplace, meaning the first experimental subjects are those that really take it when it's been approved, then we must fund and implement mechanisms to ensure that the experiment is properly monitored, the data properly analyzed, and the conclusions disseminated rapidly. That's the New England Journal of Medicine article by Alastair Wood, C. Michael Stein, and Raymond Woolsey from Georgetown University Medical Center and Vanderbilt University Medical School, respectively. What I'm really saying is, again, in the absence of looking at a new paradigm, which, as we've talked about in this issue of Functional Medicine Update, has to do with this inborn errors or inborn alterations or inborn differences in metabolism and how we modify them to improve genotype conversion to phenotype, we will potentially be locked into this cycle, the cycle being treatment of symptoms, increased risk to adverse effects, and an increased need for greater medical services downstream. There are markers, as you know, that we can use to evaluate dysfunctional metabolism that may give insight into where gene expression is increasing the risk or likelihood of various diseases, heart disease, arthritis, even cancer. One of those analytes which is receiving more attention is C-reactive protein. C-reactive protein, serum amyloid A, fibrinogen, neopterin, and ferritin are all analytes, as you know, that have been used to evaluate immunological markers. C-reactive protein is a noteworthy member of this group because of the speed and degree to which its concentration increases after a variety of inflammatory states or injuries to tissues, including myocardial injury or infarction. The test for CRP is simple and effective screening test for occult bacterial infection or tissue injury, and therefore might be considered as a marker for individuals who have inflammatory response that could be a contributor to altered gene expression that then associates with the risk to many degenerative diseases. They go on to say that an isolated CRP concentration cannot be used to assess risk for an individual because many factors other than one disease may contribute to CRP concentrations. But if you do a CRP level over time and look at its trend or its vector of change against the individual, this can be a very useful tool for assessing a reduced risk and altered cellular gene expression that's associated with the transition from an inflammatory state to a normal state. So, again, I think a very interesting use of one simple test that may give us some information, not just about a single disease, but a variety of disorders that are associated with chronic inflammation. As you probably recognize, one of the families of drugs that is receiving a considerable amount of attention recently are the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. And there are a series of papers that have appeared in the Archives of Internal Medicine, Volume 156, that describe some of the adverse side effects NSAIDs and how this produces gastropathies. I think one of the most interesting of these papers is the Volume 156, page 1530, a 1996 article out of the Stanford University Medical School, again co-authored by Dr. James Fries. This is an observational prospective cohort study looking at the appearance of gastrointestinal dysfunction, increased intestinal small bowel permeability, and gastric bleeding from the continued use of NSAIDs at the recommended dose. And what they point out is that if you're waiting for symptoms to develop before worrying about adverse side effects, that that's too late, because in the majority of the patients, there are no acute symptoms of pain or other chronic dysfunctions until there is a serious problem with perforation and bleeding. And therefore, it's said that virtually all individuals who are taking non-steroidals at the recommended dose for an extended period of time are at risk to gastrointestinal inflammatory dysfunction. Approximately 15% of patients in this study, 1,921 patients, reported an NSAID-induced GI side effect during the 2.5-year observation period. And again, I want to emphasize, if you wait till symptoms before you do something, it may be too late. I mean, it may be that you already have a pathology. Conservative calculations estimate that approximately 107,000 patients are hospitalized annually for non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug-related gastrointestinal complications, and at least 16,500 NSAID-related deaths occur each year among arthritis patients alone. This is a very serious problem with high penetration and prevalence. Again, I need to emphasize there are no reliable warning signals. Greater than 80% of patients with serious GI complications have no prior GI symptoms. Independent risk factors for serious GI events were age, prednisone use, NSAID use, disability level, and previous NSAID-induced GI symptoms. Antacids and H2 antagonists do not prevent NSAID-induced gastric ulcers. And therefore, one needs to be very worried about this if they are on long-term management of arthritis pain. So one might say, well, how do you then deal with this issue? Well, as you know, there are new selective COX-2 blocking agents that are going to be released and approved by the FDA, but I need to emphasize they're not totally selective. They still have some COX-1, cyclooxygenase 1 inhibition activity, so they're not without some adverse risk. Obviously, by lowering the load on the inflammatory cascade and increasing then the protection against inflammation, and if it starts in the gut with the case of these inflammatory mediators, then you need to consider these gut restoration programs or systemic anti-inflammation programs. This may at least lower the load of inflammatory mediators and reduce the dependency on non-steroidals or other anti-inflammatory medications. So again, a different strategy rather than just assuming, well, if you have a symptom, you take the drug and hope for the best. What we're looking at is a clinical strategy that weaves together a long-term treatment program that both protects the health in the long term while improving the health in the immediacy. Well, I think we've done a reasonable job in introducing to you the concept of molecular medicine as it's evolving, applying it to childhood behavior disorders and moving it now into other adverse drug-related dysfunctions in individuals for which total treatment programs need to be developed. We'll move this to the next level in our March 1999 issue, where we start looking at how this can play out in a variety of chronic degenerative diseases. Thanks for being with us.